The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. Thank you for joining us today, and I hope you're having a good run-up to Thanksgiving coming up later in the week. A couple of announcements, and off we go to our program. You can call us. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. And you can also Skype in, and it's computer, your computer to my computer. Use a headset to keep the feedback down. And the Skype ID is one word, The Space Show. So give it a try, and you're welcome to use Skype if you would like to. In addition, you can email us, and today we'll use Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. And the other thing I want you to remember is that we do podcast all of our programs, and we thank Andrew at gigadial.net for doing that for us. And you can find our RSS URL on our website, all of our newsletters, and that allows you to subscribe to our podcast. And remember, we're in iTunes, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and Zoom. Two of you have written to me about issues using a Droid smartphone and the podcast. I've sent you suggestions that other listeners have given. Unfortunately, nobody writes back to tell me if the suggestions are valuable or not. So I'm kind of in the dark as to whether any of the other listener ideas help because I'm not a Droid user. But I know that one listener the other day recommended an app for the Droid that seems to work very well called Google Talk. I can't tell you anything more about it than that. But you know, if you check in with me and you're having a smartphone issue, I'll do my very best to help you. And if I can't help you, I will put it out there to the listeners and maybe we'll get some fresh ideas. And to those that have received the ideas on how to make the Droid app work better, I'd really like to get your feedback so we know if this is valuable information or not. So you know how to reach me. What else do I want to tell you? Check out our website. Remember, we have a comprehensive newsletter there, and it has all of the guest bios. It has the details of the show, and it is the only place we have where you can see what's happening in the coming weeks on the Space Show. We're already booking into 2012, and we're going to have some dramatic changes in part of December, but I'm not ready to announce all that yet. But there are some things coming up that you'll need to know about. So the website newsletter will be explaining it all in detail. And, of course, I'll be doing it on air as we get closer to the important dates. And then also notice that everything we've done on the Space Show going back to 2001 can be listened to right off of our website, or you can easily download the shows. We have a Space Show store up near the top of our website. It's called Space Show Gear. And then above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. We could not do this show without your generous financial support. We thank you for that. And if you pay U.S. taxes, you get a tax donation because we are a nonprofit. And if you're paying California taxes, you also get a state of California taxes. Watch the newsletter and the blog over the next couple of days. We're putting out our annual appeal for funding, which we do every year around Thanksgiving time, because, as I said, the Space Show is only on the air because of those of you who support us, and we certainly can use your support. And then do remember that we are partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And then that brings me to our show today. So I'm happy to bring back our friend and many times over space show guest, Dave Kettledge. And he's our go-to nuclear guy. He served as a submarine nuclear research operator, control systems test engineer, for Nimitz-class carriers. You heard him do a special show with us when the tsunami hit Japan about the runaway problems of Japanese nuclear power plant. We tried to get some sanity out there into a crazy news marketplace where everything was being said, and including the fact that our air molecules were glowing at night. So Dave is a real nuclear systems engineer, and he has a new book out, and it's electronic or on a CD, 2033, The Nuclear Mission to Mars. And we're going to be talking about this book. It's about 694-95 pages, and what he has done is he has detailed a way to have a manned mission go to Mars that is nuclear derived. And he uses all of his experience in the nuclear industry, his education from the Navy and the power plant companies to put this book together. And you can get it online. He'll tell you how to do that. But he has chapters in his book such as Why Go to Mars, Human Factors, Artificial Gravity, Propulsion, Reactor Theory and Design, Controls, Landers, Mars Surface Operations, Heavy Lift, and on and on and on. Dave, welcome back to the show. How you doing?
Very good, David. And once again, an honor to be on the space show. I'm thrilled to be putting out the new book, 2033, The Nuclear Mission to Mars. I think it represents a very candid snapshot in time, where we stand, what is our technical potential for mounting a manned mission to Mars and to send a crew out, land them on the surface, have them stay for up to 150 days, if not more, up to a year maybe, then launch back and return to Earth. And doing this book, what motivated me was a discussion that you and I had, and along with Dr. Robert Zerbin when he was on the show back this spring, and the interesting discussion that we had in the propulsion area in regards to Vasmir compared to nuclear thermal engines. And I was convinced, along with Robert, that at the end of that discussion, Vasmir, for lightweight payloads, has great potential. However, it is not ready, nor will it likely be ready for decades for any substantial manned missions due to the power requirements and the size of the radiator. So with that being said, I wanted to put a book together that kind of gelled everything from the nuclear power industry, from submarining, from aerospace engineering, and kind of take all the experience and kind of my life having a dual career, so to speak, nuclear and aerospace, putting it all together. And what better thing to do than manned mission to Mars? Because we've all been watching over the last 2 years with the Obama administration, the Augustine Commission report. We've all been watching the game going back and forth of where we're going with NASA and manned exploration and manned spaceflight. And I am more than grateful that Senator Nelson and others in Congress took the bull by the horns and got the Space Launch System and Heavy Lift program off the ground, somewhat begrudgingly from the administration, but it was the right call, and I'll go into that reason. So why should we be going to Mars? From a scientific standpoint, we discuss in Chapter 1 why we should go. Right now, we've had three significant landers, Spirit, Opportunity, and Phoenix. Spirit and Opportunity, and I've had the honor to meet Steve Squires. He came down to University of Illinois, and I got to meet him, and it was a wonderful discussion. And he wasn't anything that I would have expected, you know, someone, you know, of such, you know, grandeur in JPL to come across as. Very friendly, very forthcoming, and very passionate about the Mir landers. But what the Mir landers taught us is that Mars was wet, Mars was warm, it had a substantial atmosphere, and it had water. Basically, when Opportunity landed, it landed right in a hole in one, and when it opened up and looked at the far wall, it saw hematite, and the only way you make hematite is in the presence of water. And when the rover rolled on out and looked down, my God, here were these little mineral spheres of hematite, and you saw this layered pattern in the rock as if it was a sandy kind of beach line that had waves over it, as if it was a little pond. And it was like everybody at JPL's looking, and my associates are all looking, and we're going, oh, my God, we've got water. So the theory of going where the water is at Mars is an absolutely valid idea. So the reason to go to Mars is really the reason we don't know if we're going to find fossils or we're going to find something living on the ground. A few weeks ago, I saw pictures from MRO, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, come back. And over the seasons, here was this valley, and it changed color. And it went from a light red to this deep red kind of wine kind of color. And I went, my God, it's groundwater. So we have running groundwater on Mars right now. And I don't think anybody on this planet can tell me, is there life there or isn't there life there? Now, I can send robots, but robots are not as nimble as a human being, and they don't have all the tools for drilling and excavating and exploring that a human mission would have. Now, some of us are old enough to remember the Apollo program and how much it changed this country in terms of the engineering spectrum of who wanted to be scientists and who wanted to be astronauts and who wanted to do rocketry. It changed this country in great positive ways. It helped us advance in our technology. I sincerely believe that. I saw it in firsthand in the telecommunications industry. That being said, the day we put a human footprint on Mars to explore will be an exciting day that will go down in history like Christopher Columbus. So not only is the science valid to go, the technical and national interests strongly support sending a manned mission. Now, yes, it has risk. It has dangers. That should not dissuade anybody. Taking measured risks is part of exploration. Christopher Columbus didn't turn around to Queen Isabella and say, gee, I'm too scared to go. I'm going. I'm an explorer. I know something's out there. I'm going to find it, period. You pick up your sword, you march, and you do the mission. And you need that same kind of mentality. And that's kind of when the question comes up of who do you send to Mars? It's funny, in a way, because in Chapter 2, we talk about crew factors. And the chapter is based on a NASA study about long-term space exploration. And what's interesting in reading that, they keep citing Antarctica and submarines. Well, I've spent a few years. In fact, I spent 6 years under the sea. I've been out for months at a time. Little to no communication from home. No spare parts other than what I've got with me. And I've got to keep a power plant running and technical equipment working and air and electricity going. And I've got to make sure said submarine does said mission. And eventually, I'm going to go home. So all the psychological issues and sociological issues you run into on submarines are very similar to deep space. The only difference is gravity. And we're going to get to that also.
You want to take some questions? Because you're getting a lot of questions. And it probably works better if we have a discussion. So the first one is Paul in Denver, and says a few minutes ago you're talking about how important in the national interest all of this should be. The problem I see is that the national interest doesn't support what you're talking about. If it did support it, we would not find our space program in the condition that it's in, dating back not just from Obama's term, but going back to decades of how space policy has been misused and how it has not been explained properly to the American people, so that there is a groundswelling to do what we in the space community think is in our national interest. I'm wondering if your book addresses how to reach and communicate not only the general public, but members of Congress that clearly do not share your views on space as part of the national interest, especially going to Mars.
Well, here's my response to that. It certainly, that issue is bigger than just myself. I'm an engineer. I think like an engineer, although I did politics also in college. So I understand the political spectrum and trying to motivate people to take on new goals and take on a new perspective. And I kind of follow that up every time I go into a business meeting. I walk into a room and I size up what's the other players all thinking about. And I don't voice an opinion about that. It's just for my own information. What we really need in the space community is a concerted effort collectively, and I underword the word collectively, to motivate the country and Congress, because right now the current administration is not holding up anything to hold up the aerospace industry. I see them as the greatest danger economically that I've seen in my 50 years.
Okay, but I don't want to do partisan stuff on the show.
I'm not going to get away from that.
But remember, Dave, hold on, wait a minute.
Have to have a concerted effort to make it a national goal.
Okay,
and
but
it's going to take a decade.
Dave, remember, Bush does the VSE. He never mentions it again, not even in a State of the Union thing. It's not funded, although it is supported by two different sets of Congresses of both parties, but it's not financially supported. And back then, our economy had not nearly deteriorated to the degree it has deteriorated, you know, 4, 5, 6 years later with $15 trillion of debt. So this problem, as much as maybe a lot of us would like to lay it on the hands of this or that president or this or that member of Congress or something like that, this goes back decades to where we have not been able to manifest a policy that really resonates with the American people and that Congress is willing to fund to fruition. And I've got it on the show. I'm betting that when they get about $10 billion into SLS, Congress will cancel the program, that we will never see that program built, developed, and brought to fruition. That's, if I had any money and there were takers out there, that was my bet. In fact, I wonder if you can bet on the completion of SLS on Intrade, you know, that internet website that gives you odds on everything, even if I can lose 50 pounds by February of next year. But that would be a cool thing to see if you could get the odds on SLS being completed on intrade.com.
Well, we need SLS.
I'm not arguing that, but
in order to mount a Mars mission, you need something, a Saturn V class or SLS class size booster.
Even with a nuclear rocket?
Yes. Because from looking at the numbers, I can basically, the model I came up with was simply this. Two Delta IV heavies to bring up the engines. Once the engines are in orbit, one SLS launch to bring up fuel, a second SLS launch to bring up about 150,000 pounds of basically the crew hub to attach to the fuel, attach to the engines, then set up your navigation, do final assembly, final checkout, and off you go.
When you say deltas, would you substitute Falcon or Atlas V?
Oh, sir. Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly.
You already have a call.
What I basically need is 38,000 pounds. 38,000 pounds per engine.
You've already sparked the audience. You have a caller already ready to go for you. You ready for this one?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Terry in Corpus Christi, David.
Hi, Terry. Welcome back to the show and a happy Thanksgiving week to you.
Well, same to you, too.
Go for it.
Okay, three different questions. He's probably been beat to death on this. But chemical versus nuclear mission to Mars, cost-wise, how do they match up?
Actually, there's not from cost. Cost isn't the driving factor. Yes, you could use J2X as it is right now and use a bunch of them in order to get the roughly 3.5 kilometer per second delta V that you need to eject from Earth to get to Mars. The nuclear option is just the same price. In fact, all I need to do right now, because I had the engines working in 1972. When you go back and reread, if you're a nuclear engineer and you go back and reread the NASA rover report dated 1991, we had working engines, we had a working rover program, and we had running prototype engines. The only thing I've suggested in my book is instead of the Kiwi B4 style fuel, switching that to a pebble bed. And the reason for that is to increase the specific impulse from 825 to 1,000, which gets me more payload margin. Now, here's the reason to go nuclear. If I go chemical and go to Mars with a manned mission, it's 60 rem to the crew, unexposed, meaning unshielded, meaning just the crew sitting in the void of space, sitting on the outside of said ship, it's 60 rem for the mission. If I go nuclear, it's around 40 to 45 rem. I cut my radiation dose. Why? Because I get to Mars faster. And faster means less time, means less dose. That's the reason to go nuclear. So going nuclear cuts your dose from the sun, and from galactic sources. So, your economic question, the cost is roughly the same. I can build one prototype reactor in under 5 years, put it on a test stand, and then build two more. And I can do it the same cost that a J2X would have cost. Because I've already got all of the drawings and all the plans of the previously developed engines from 1972. And the tweaking of the fuel to a pebble bed design is a minor increment. All the feed systems, the engine hardware is basically the same. In fact, If you go to the Nuclear Testing Museum in Las Vegas, and my younger brother took me there, I turned the corner, saw the XE Prime nuclear engine 4 feet away from me, and I looked up and I went, oh, my God, I know who you are. Why aren't we flying you?
Are you talking about the same nuclear engine design as Brilliant Pebbles, where it blows off a series of atomic bomb propulsion?
Oh, no.
Okay.
This was a reactor core made that was graphite moderated, 52 inches tall, 35 inches in diameter, and the reflector was probably another 3 to 4 inches. So you're probably talking 40, 42, 45 inches diameter for that engine, which was basically the prototype to the Nerva class engine.
Okay. Terry?
The pebble bed, the only difference is we increased the diameter from 35 inches to 46. And the reason to increase that is to increase the volume so I get more megawatts, but at the same rate of fission in the engine.
Terry, what's your second question? Oh, are you still there, Terry?
Terry?
I am.
Oh, okay.
Yes. What do you think about a hybrid nuclear ion engine combination for deep space?
Well, it has valid aspects in this manner. The point that you're making, and if I'm interpreting your question correctly, is the hybrid engine. What you get from a nuclear engine is you run it under the fission process for approximately 20 minutes worth of time, and you hit escape velocity, and you're on your way to Mars. But now, even with the reactor shut down, there is a term in nuclear power we call decay heat. When you split the atom of uranium, you get fission fragments, and they fall on a curve called the May-West curve because it's two probabilities, one being lighter, one being heavier. So those two isotopes that are fission fragments are unstable, and they want to get stable. And the only way they get stable is they emit energy, and that is decay heat. So when you put your rods into a reactor, it's been running at 100% power. 7% heat is still being generated with the control rods in. This is what made Fukushima bad. This is what made TMI bad. So decay heat can be utilized. I can wrap my engine with a heat exchanger, put a little gas turbine on it, and I can get all the electricity. I can probably take 7% over the prior 2 weeks of operation, and that is the amount of heat that I get per engine that I can extract. And I probably get 30, 40, 45% of that as electricity. And if I've got electricity, I can use it for propulsion. I can use it for electrical use. I think that answers your question.
Yes, sir. Last question. What are the odds of a nuclear mission to Mars in our lifetime?
Well, I'm in my 50s. And it's probably going to be a stretch for my generation. So I'm kind of pitching the football by writing this book. You know, part of my role in the National Association of Rocketry and the Tripoli Rocketry Association, because I go out, I get to talk to young people. And I get to go down on occasion to University of Illinois, and I get to talk graduate students, and it's invigorating to see the sparkle in their eyes. There are young people out there who have the thirst to be engineers, to be rocketeers. And our associations do everything we can to make sure that they're educated, they're inspired, because the only way our hobby stays alive is bringing in young people. The American Modelers Association for Radio Control Airplanes has the same issue. They have to bring in young people to stay alive because their ranks are getting old, they're retiring, and they're sadly passing away. So in model rocketry, we're very interested in education. And we talk to moms, we talk to dads, we talk to 4-H clubs, and we go out on our own time, not to make a profit at all, and we're trying to grassroots motivate young people. And what better way to do it than say, your generation's going to Mars. My generation went to the moon. Your generation has a future, and it looks like this. Read my book. That's my mission. I don't do this for economic gain. Yes, I make a few bucks here and there so I can go to a hobby store. But my real motivation is to make sure those young people all have the chance. Now, I'll give you one of my favorite stories. I got to go down to UVI, and I was invited to an AIAA dinner. And the dean had somebody from JPL coming in to talk about deep space, flying missions out to Jupiter and Saturn. And he unfortunately got stuck in St. Louis. And the dean turned to me and said, Dave, we lost the keynote speaker. Can you be the keynote speaker? And I kind of went, oh, my God. Yeah, I guess so. So for 45 minutes, I told them about rocketry and education. And I showed them some video. I left the propulsion professor with his jaw on the ground, salivating strongly, because he was thrilled seeing a couple of my longer-haired friends walking out to a pad, smiling, going, I'm going to 50,000 feet today. Watch this. And as I was talking to those students and that audience, I saw the sparkle in their eyes. And they were on exactly the same wavelength that I was. It was the best speech of my entire life. And when I got done, I gave them these words, because they're prophetic. I have a dear friend in Colorado Springs, Tim Milligan. He runs a company called Apogee Components. He's a hobby maker. Does the best, most beautiful scale Saturn V and Saturn 1B kits you would ever want. I really recommend them. They're not cheap, but by golly, they're museum quality. Tim has a poster, and it's this young man holding a model rocket in his hand. And in the background is a space shuttle arching over into orbit. And the caption on the bottom reads this: the road to space starts with a model rocket. And as I turned to that group of 150, I said, it's my responsibility, it's my obligation to make sure those students meet people like me so they can come to great colleges like U of I. When I got done, I got a standing ovation. Really choked me up. I was just thrilled just to be in the room with those people. And here I got to do something that was a dream of my life. And that those chances don't come often. And the reason I do what I do is because moments like that matter. Because every time you educate somebody about space, it's a step forward for all of us. And we all have to pick up the stick, and we have to somehow motivate those who are still staring at the ground and teach them to look up, because it's important. We need to get off Earth eventually. That's why I write my books, and I have a lot of fun at it at the same time.
Terry, do you have anything more?
No, sir. Thank you very much for your time, and both of you have a great holiday.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Listeners, you can access the toll-free line again. It is 1-866-687-7223, and you have an email message from your brother. You ready for this one? Dave, this is Rick, your bro. Can you? That's what he says.
My younger brother Rick in Las Vegas.
By the way, I checked InTrade. There are no odds on Mars missions, nuclear rockets, nuclear missions, nuclear power, space exploration. I don't know how you start odds on a subject. They do have a field for science and for technology, and they have a few. God, your phone's ringing again. You're bringing them off the wall. Oh, and they do have a few NASA things, but nothing at all along the lines of here. So, listeners, if any of you know how InTrade works, and we ought to get started a manned mission to Mars by 2020 or 2033. It looks like you put dates in them, and then you can have three or four different ones, because what are the odds of it by this date or that date? And I don't know how it works, but it's a lot of fun, at least, and it gives us some kind of an independent thing. Okay, your brother. Dave, this is Rick, your bro. Can you expand on the more motivating needs of a mission? This country has a crisis of confidence, in my opinion. No blank, Sherlock. Your thoughts on how this mission could help drive us and provide changes needed to make this country a leader once again. U.S. hitching rides with the Ruskies is just wrong. And apparently he has a blog, The Vegas Catches. Am I doing that right? The Vegas Catches? I'll put it in the archives, everybody.blogspot.com. Okay, what do you say to Brother Rick?
Well, I say good afternoon, Rick, and he's right in a way. We have to realize, you know, even with all the trials and tribulations of the 1960s, I fondly remember growing up in the 60s and early 70s and watching the Apollo program and feeling the sense of pride, national pride, that this country had. And I felt it every day when I went home. My father was with Bell Laboratories, and my world was technology, 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 and the space program is great. So I had an incredibly fortunate upbringing. And I conveyed it to my friends. I conveyed it to family. You know, I've always been the guy who loved rocketry. But you have to be able to motivate other people. And you have to do it from a community standpoint and then at a national level. It's really in our national interests. If you look at the balance of payments in this country, aviation is one of the big plus factors in our balance of payments. Having a healthy aerospace industry, including a space program, has an absolute direct financial impacts into the wealth and well-being of this country. I have no doubt about that. Yes, you can do one study or another study of how many dollars returned on investment of this or that. But when you look at the sociological changes that you invoke in college enrollments, in engineering, in technology, in people taking up the wrench and doing something technical and advancing, and the entire collective consciousness of a nation can be motivated. The current world we live in right now has issues with that. Now, I seem to remember a previous president by the name of Reagan So I had no doubt whatsoever that that man absolutely believed in the American spirit. And we in the military thought he was the best human being that we had ever come across because he absolutely believed in his country. That's what you need. You need that American spirit. And that American spirit never gives up, always seeks a solution. There are never a failure as a situation. You always look for a solution. You always press ahead. And even when you have bad days, you motivate them, you get past it, and you seek the future. No ifs, no ands, no buts. You know, I got to read the Apollo 13 book from, I'm trying to remember it, Failure is Not an Option.
Oh.
And I read it from cover to cover, and I thought it was one of the most motivating books I had read in years. And I thought it was a wonderful text, and I said, you know, every student in America should be reading books like this, because if you motivate the kids, you'll motivate the family. And if you can motivate the families, you're going somewhere. So education matters, but you have to motivate. And the way you motivate is by appealing to the collective future, and you make it as big and as bright as you can. We have a future in space. We truly do. But you have to be willing to take the risk to move forward. And there will be losses. I have no doubt about that. But any great adventure, any great exploration has risk. And being able to handle risk is part of the game. It's part of the can-do spirit. And you have to be willing to take the risk to reap the benefit. Otherwise, you shouldn't be even in the card game.
You have another caller on hold. Hi, caller. Who are you, please? Hello? Are you there? Caller? Are you there, caller? Going once, twice. Call back. You did have a caller on hold.
Oh.
I guess you're not. So let's going back to your book until the next questions come in. And you're sort of going through the outline and what's in the book. I think you were getting up to around the third chapter or so before we started getting the questions.
Yeah. Basically, to touch on human factors a little bit, when you're an isolated crew on a long-duration mission for months away from home, you find that little factors like color, decorum, food, all matter. The interrelationship between crewmates also is a big factor. Having married couples may be a sound choice for going to Mars, you know, as long as everybody, you know, gets along. You know, there will be days where people will have disagreements. However, knowing that you have a mission to accomplish, that you have a routine for maintenance, that you have a work structure that is not heavily overloaded, because overloaded schedules lead to stress, and stress causes inefficiency and errors. So from a human factor standpoint, you really want a crew that's well-balanced, who has worked together for years at a time before you send them off on a multi-year mission. And they have to be able to fill in and have a cross-discipline spirit. So you certainly want one medical officer on board, but that medical officer may be a geologist or an exobiologist also. you need somebody who's maintenance intensive, and certainly some at least two who's a pilot and a co-pilot kind of situation to be able to fly the associated vehicles. So human factors really has to be well understood. When you get to Chapter 3, we're talking about the mission itself. And what we based this on was very much the NASA reference mission version 3 and a little bit of version 4. And, of course, Dr. Zerbin's significant work of the case for Mars. What Dr. Zerbin did when he wrote the case for Mars, which had a lot of resistance initially, Zerbin came up with in-situ resource use, which is simply taking the CO2 out of the atmosphere at Mars, combining it with hydrogen to get methane, water, oxygen. So, before I ever land a manned crew on Mars, I've got water for them, I've got fuel, I've got liquid oxygen, and I have propellant tanks for the trip back to orbit. Already done before they ever set foot. So, the first pair of missions is a MAV, which is a manned ascent vehicle, and a lander that stays in orbit. And that orbiter or that lander is basically stocked with food and exploration equipment and what have you. So when the crew arrives in orbit from their crew transfer vehicle, they move into the lander, they execute a precision landing next to the MAV, which is manned asset vehicle, ascent vehicle, and they do their exploration period, which could be up to 500 days. At the end of 500 days, they launch, they go back into orbit, dock with the crew transfer vehicle and their habitat, and they fly back to Earth. At the same time, as I discuss in the book, we apply artificial gravity by using a tether system where you have a 1,000-foot tether spun at 1.7 RPM, and you get approximately 0.98 G for the crew. So the transit time between Earth and Mars, they're under a G of gravity. There's none of this zero gravity, bone loss issue, and problems with the eyes, problems with the heart, cardiovascular-wise. So you have, on the trip to Mars and the trip back, you have a healthy crew.
You have another caller online. Let's, caller, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
This is Marshall, and I'd like to read a little data here, and I'd like you to confirm it, and then move on to the obvious next question. And obviously, the nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and nuclear-powered submarines, so I kind of looked up how safe is are these nuclear reactors. And I came up with, since 1948, the U.S. nuclear program has developed 27 different power plant designs and installed it on 210 nuclear-powered ships.
Yep.
Accumulated 5,400 reactor years of operation, 128 million miles, and have had absolutely no accidents.
And absolutely a true statement.
How do you know they're not?
When Admiral Rickover established the submarine program, our nuclear power program for the Nautilus, which was the first prototype, the first training program, he handpicked his officers. You had to meet Admiral Rickover in his office. And there are some stories about having an Admiral Rickover interview. And Rickover handpicked every officer because they were the leaders who oversaw the reactor plant operations for people like myself. I was a reactor operator for S3G Core 3 S5W engine rooms. So it took me 2 years of school. There, all the exams, there was never, ever a multiple choice test. The final oral board lasted, I think mine ran 7.5 hours. And then when I met my sub to qualify as reactor operator, which took another about 10 months, I had to do the oral board and the written exam all over again. And every year after that, I got to sit down with naval reactors. They would fly from Washington. They would arrive at our submarine. And it was, as we used to say, Jaime's henchmen. They'd be on board for 3 days, and nobody got any sleep. And boy, did you work. You would drill. You would take exams. You would have interviews. And you better pull a 3.2 or better. Because failure was never an option.
Exactly. And I was thinking that the Navy's nuclear program is the basis for saying that the nuclear reactors in space is probably going to be right along the same lines, because they learned so much since 1948 about putting these small nuclear reactors in a submarine and then carrying it into long-term space missions. There should be a very close relationship between the
two. There should be. Naval Reactors has, on multiple occasions, assisted DOE and other agencies, and I don't know the details of that at depth, but they have worked with other agencies. In the book, there's a very interesting report by, I want to say the last name was Bass. It was on tungsten fast fission reactors, and one of the co-authors of the story of the report was Mr. Bess. And Mr. Bess was, I believe, working for the Idaho National Laboratory, which is partly owned by Naval Reactors and Department of Energy. So in answer to your question, yes, Naval Reactors is involved and should be, because they absolutely demand excellence out of their operators. I've lived their program. It was probably the most career-enhancing environment I've ever been in. Certainly from an occupational standpoint, because I went from being a reactor operator to being a test engineer working for Westinghouse, then leading a maintenance department, and then the Navy offered me a job in San Diego, and my family said they had had enough at that point, and we went commercial at that point.
By the way, I seem to remember that President Carter was a nuclear submarine officer, right?
Yes, he was. And Rickover did not have the greatest of words. I'll just say, Kurt, that Rickover had said some things. He said he was that Mr. Carter, or Lieutenant Carter, was not one of the shiniest, brightest crayons that he had taught, but he did pass muster.
Yeah, he got through the program.
He made it through the program, and the program is, as I said, very intense academically. Overall, I would say the dropout rate for the academic portion, because there's an academic portion followed by 6 months of running a live reactor, which, again, has substantial exams and oral boards. The dropout rate's roughly about 50%. because people can't cut the program because the intensity and the volume of academic material. Because you have to learn thermodynamics, physics, electronics, materials, and it's all college level material. I think when I went and got my BS degree, I had 38 credit hours thanks to Naval Nuclear Power.
Marshall, anything else?
Well, I just wanted to point out that the naval record basically puts to shame the civilian nuclear record. People that go around, you know, referring to Fukushima and saying, oh, the, you know, nuclear's terrible, bad, shut it all down, is ignoring the whole naval record. And I really get kind of upset over that. Thank you very much. Let you go.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. And listeners, 1-866-687-7223. And more of your family has called in. What are you giving us, family hour here, David? Okay, so this is from your sister.
Oh, Carol.
Carol, absolutely. Is she in Las Vegas, too?
Carol is up in beautiful Gig Harbor, Washington, one of the prettiest places on the face of the planet, close to the Trident submarine base up there.
Okay.
I spent a couple years in Bangor, Washington. Absolutely loved the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it is beautiful country. Here. Okay, Carol says, hi, brother. As usual, I listen in awe of the depth and breadth of your knowledge and enthusiasm. Given that I represent the artistic rather than the technical side of the family, can you address the, quote, human factors based on life aboard submarines, besides physically protecting the crew from space and each other? What would be done to enhance their daily experience taking artists in the crew? This is not tongue-in-cheek. Psychologically, such a creative experience can be highly beneficial and add to crew compatibility.
Carol has a point. Music was kind of amongst a crew, one of the most traded things, music, arts, pictures. You did not, if you walked through a submarine berthing area, you could always tell where the married guys lived because there were kid pictures, family pictures, photo albums, art, and you kind of got this swath of family life in a space, you know, 2.5 feet wide, 6.5 feet long, and maybe 1.5 feet tall. And crews had special meals. We celebrated Thanksgiving and holidays and Halloween and Christmas. And the crews would all get dressed up, you know, like Santa or make pumpkins, do something artistic. And the swelling of the morale of the crew around the event would make, you know, the day after day after day drudgery go away. I used to love, you know, mid-patrol meals because the cooks would, and this was the other big thing, was meals. The cooks would march out with Alaskan king crab legs, and we would feast, literally feast, and have a great meal. And events like that really bring up a very positive impact to a crew. So Carol's right, art and food and decor all have a big impact because even the small things matter when you're out to sea.
We're an hour into the show. We're going to take a break since we missed our bottom of the hour break. Listeners, we'll be back with Dave and more on his book, 2033, The Nuclear Mission to Mars, 3 minutes Don't go anywhere. We will be back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Sunday Space Show. And our guest today, Dave Kettledge, we're talking about his new book, which Dave has to tell us how to get. He hasn't done that yet. 2033, The Nuclear Mission to Mars. You can call us at 1-866-687-7223. You can Skype in. The ID is one word, The Space Show. And email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we'll open up with a question you have from a listener that came in during the break. This is Greg in Austin, Texas. And he says, Dave and Dave, are you aware? That's right, Dave and Dave, that's the two of us. Are you aware that there is a petition out there on the Internet to stop Mars Science Lab because it is carrying radioactive material? It already has thousands of signatures on it. How do you intend to get beyond the resentment in the community, or maybe fear is a better word, against nuclear anything? How can you launch anything that is nuclear if we're all afraid that nuclear is going to do us all harm? We can't seem to get beyond that. Also, I seem to recall that we are trying to get something like 16 to 18 nuclear power plants approved in the United States, and those permits for approval have been sitting there for a number of years.
Yes, I'm aware that there are people who have tribulations or are concerned about thermal heating. RTG kind of power source in the Curiosity lander. It's absolutely essential because of the dust issues on the surface of Mars. The sounder choice was to literally go nuclear with RTGs on Curiosity, and because there's more electrical load on Curiosity landers as compared to Spirit and Opportunity, where solar arrays could, do the job. But we've learned, through the Mir missions, just what the dust buildup problems can be and how it affects solar arrays. So nuclear was technically the better choice. The only way to really fix the problem with the public in terms of nuclear power is a concerted effort, be it the Discovery Channel, be it the Science Channel, and experts sitting down, getting on TV, ripping the teleprompters away from the Jane Fondas and going, listen, radiation is all around you. It looks like this. If you live in Houston, if you live in Denver, you get radiation. If you go out to the store and buy a bunch of bananas, you're getting a little extra potassium, and that potassium sometimes is radioactive. You're not going to drop dead from it. Now, in my book, in 2033, The Nuclear Mission to Mars, I tell you in chapters 5 and in chapter 6 on radiation control, I give you the complete factual 50 years of knowledge on radiation management. Now, if I zap myself with radiation to 20 rem and I take a sample of my blood, you won't see a single blood cell deformed. Now, if I zap myself in one dose at 25 rem, you'll see a few cells change. If I zap myself with 100 or 250 rem, which is a horrendous amount of exposure, now you're going to get physical sickness, you're going to have nausea, you're going to have the onset of radiation sickness. So, if you're the average American gets 0.2 to 0.3 rem every year of their lives. People like myself who work in the power industry get about half a rem a year for 30 years, and we're not falling over. So all this fear about radioactive material, they don't understand the subject matter. They're not scientists. They're not physicists. They don't have nuclear engineering backgrounds. But what they want to do is to make you scared because people are too ignorant. And the only way to fix ignorance is education. And okay. You have to have a concerted effort. And I have to fault my industry that we need to do a better job educating people.
Okay,
we have to teach them the truth.
All right, but just to be the devil's advocate here, most of their fear centers around a rocket blowing up or plutonium coming back into the atmosphere and scattering and being extremely radioactive and dispersing over a really wide area, almost virtually impossible to clean up. So from what I can tell, they are concerned about a plutonium risk reentering the Earth's atmosphere from a failed launch. So how do you address that?
You can armor in the LEM programs when the lunar modules took up nuclear power sources to the moon. They were basically encapsulated in a ballistic bullet. So if the vehicle blew up, this thing would just, you know, fall out of the rocket and just plunk into the ocean. You design the reactors that are mentioned in my book are so turned off, they are so heavily poisoned by boron and other materials that even if they fell in the ocean, they would never start up. They would never go critical. They would never expose anybody to radiation.
Okay, so we've had two nuclear rocket accidents. One was Russia and Canada that had a huge cleanup. And didn't the U.S. have one in Ecuador or something that had a huge cleanup problem?
I knew about the Russian one. I did not know of the case in Ecuador.
So there, the plutonium, the containers did not contain, and you had a wide area that had to go in and be cleaned up, right?
Yeah.
Or were they not
the
engineered?
The Russians have never been known for their ability for radiological control. I'll just leave it at that.
So do we protest a Russian nuclear vehicle, and we bless an American nuclear vehicle because our engineering is better. Is that what our? I'm trying to be the devil's advocate here.
Well,
is that the takeaway?
Our engineering is better, but you have to design it into the vehicle prior to you launching. Yes, there is a minor risk, but you have to sit there and realize the amount of dispersal that you would get is so widespread. You're talking picocuries of material that any human being would be exposed to. So the dispersal would be so wide, and if you design the vehicle right, you can make it all come down as one slug and have it fall into the ocean, without a doubt.
You have a caller on hold again, so we'll get back to your book. Don't worry about it. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John, Atlanta.
Okay. Are you glowing in the dark down there? Have you been radiated today?
No. Okay. I guess I get my 0.2 to 0.3, I guess. Whatever that is of yours. Now, I was wondering, you made the comments about the chemical versus nuclear versus Vasimir. On your nuclear thermal concept, what sort of trajectories are you looking to achieve? I assume you're going to do a higher speed than a basic Holmann transfer orbit. Is that correct?
It's an opposition kind of transfer that has been modeled. However, the vehicle that I've outlined is, allow me to briefly describe said vehicle. 150,000 pounds of payload, meaning the habitat and crew, 218,000 pounds of propellant, and two Nerva pebble bed-based engines with a specific impulse of 1,000, each engine producing a Nerva-class thrust of 75,000 pounds. So entire vehicle delta-V capability is nearly 20,000 feet per second. All that is needed is 11,311 feet per second to basically eject out of Earth orbit and head for Mars. So there's roughly, I want to say, 8,000, 9,000 feet per second delta V available for shortening your trip time, so to speak. So most of the models are opposition class, or you speed it up a little bit and get there earlier. So before Mars is directly, you know, in front of you, when you meet it, you basically meet Mars sooner, kind of over on the clockwise direction.
Yeah. Okay,
so the idea is to get there and get there as fast as you can, and then the really tough part is aerobraking into the atmosphere and doing that effectively, and that's one of the new technology areas we should be exploring in depth with a couple explorer-type missions.
Okay, so you're going to aerobrake into Mars orbit then when you get there.
Yes, you can. You can.
Okay.
And it saves on fuel.
And then what's your transit time then with that?
About 5 months. Between 5 and 5.5 months. The goal for the transit out and the transit back is to cut radiation dose a factor of 4. Then, by placing fuel, using water, and putting in what I want to use is borated polyethylene shielding. I want to reduce dose another 10th factor, which is a common phrase used in the submarine community for the thickness of material. Commonly, nuclear power plants, 2 feet of water is 1/10th factor. But for galactic radiation, because of the energy is higher, that factor, instead of being 2 feet, is 4 feet. So, and for polyethylene, it's 4 inches in commercial nuclear power. So from galactic sources, you would want that 8 inches thick to drop a factor of 10. So by putting that shielding in and advancing your trip time, you've effectively 4 times 10, you've cut your rad dose a factor of 40, and a total mission exposure of, say, up to 60 rem is now 1.5 for the entire mission. And 1.5 over 3 years is the federal limit.
Okay. That's
so,
the improvement.
So you basically, you're right at the federal rad limits for the trip out, trip back, and thanks to a little bit of shielding and getting to Mars quick and coming home quick.
And so you're assuming the entire crew then lands on Mars and gets there rather than anybody orbiting?
You could leave people
at
moons of
Mars.
Big
part of the time in a typical mission.
Yeah. The typical model has everybody land at Mars. You could leave people in orbit because the moons of Mars, if you're standing there, the moon of the Mars effectively acts as a radiation shield because it cuts half the dose of the sky away from you because you're standing on the surface. So it's kind of being on the other side of a flat piece of paper, and the radiation can't go through the paper, which is the surface of your moon, which is miles thick. So the radiation isn't coming through the moon other than neutrinos, and neutrinos don't affect human beings. So,
Also, given that the NERVA project was canceled about, 1973, I believe.
Yeah.
How difficult or how much money, time do you think, how you want to put it?
I could probably, I could foresee it being done in 5 years.
5 years.
5 years to make a prototype. You want to make a new kind of fuel element. If you read in the book, you see the Kiwi B4 fuel type, which was hexagonal, 3/4 inch on a flat shape with 19 niobium coated tubes running down the length of the fuel element. Each fuel element was making 1.3 megawatts of power at full power. So, fuel element was 52 inches tall. The entire core for the NERVA class, which had an ISP of 825, had a radius of around 35 inches. What we're suggesting is go from 35 inches, increase that volume to 46, go from 1,570 megawatts thermal and raise that to 2,000 megawatts thermal, because we go from an ISP of 825 and now we're up at an ISP of 1,000. So I've gained 20% more efficiency in the engine.
Yeah.
Which makes my payload issues and my weight margins and my design problems not as constrained. And I can get there faster and more efficiently than using like a J2X Rocketdyne engine.
Okay. Makes sense. I do agree with you that the nuclear thermal is the technology that's ready for full scale development whenever anybody can make the decision.
And everything I read in the 1972 report that comes with the book, it was a wonderful, as a former reactor operator, it was a wonderful read. I absolutely, every page I turned and I read over, it was just, the whole document was talking to me of what they were developing, and I really greatly enjoyed the NERVA report from DOE NASA. which really showed we had a mature operating engine system, and we were ready to build Nerva in 1972 based on the B4 fuel. The only thing we're advancing is to go to pebble bed, because pebble bed I can take and run it up temperature-wise to 3,100 degrees Kelvin and an ISP of 1,000. And all that is explained in Chapter 5 of the book. That lays out all the charts. There's also the tungsten fast fission reactor reports by Mr. Bess from INL, and it has some outstanding charts in it that clearly shows you should be making your engines in terms of the pebble bed. You have a uranium carbide nugget in the center. Soft carbon surrounds that, and the soft carbon absorbs any fission gases that you produce as you're fissioning from your pellet. Surrounded that by a hard shell of zirconium carbide. And then you basically center this into a hexagonal matrix. So why go pebble bed? Comes down to this. If you look at the B4 fuel with the 19 tubes going down it, and look at the surface area, and then look at pebble bed. Pebble bed has 10 times the surface area. So what I've done in this reactor design is I've maintained the same fission rate in the fuel. And I've done all the calculations. It's all explained in the book in detail. In fact, I give you the Department of Energy reactor theory manuals so you can understand all the things that go in a reactor core. Well, what you get is the same rate of fission. You've increased the surface area a factor of 10. And power has increased because you've increased volume of the core. So in for the gas, for the 75 pounds mass per second flowing through the engine, you have gone, you've raised it to 31 to 3150 degrees Kelvin. It is at 1,000 PSIG, and then you squeeze it down convergent-divergent nozzle and out the tail end, and you get your ISP of 1,000. When I worked the spreadsheet, I was just, oh, my God, look at these numbers. They're beautiful. So, yes, when I looked at the numbers, I was convinced, absolutely, to go a nuclear thermal.
Oh, okay, well, thanks a lot there. I appreciate that. I'll have to look for that book. I guess it's on Amazon now.
You can find the book if you go to hobbyspace.com.
Uh-huh.
If you go to hobbyspace, look on the right side. You'll see a little icon on the right side. That'll take you to my website, and you'll read about my book. Go to the order page, and if you order just that book, it's $30. It also comes with the flight simulator, so you can fly the entire mission. Not only do you get to read about all this great stuff, you can actually fly the mission using Orbiter. Greatest piece of software, highly addictive.
Yeah.
It's so much fun to fly. But I have the Orbiter program that flies the entire mission model, and that comes with the book. Go to the order page, place an order. I usually get things out in 2 to 3 days in the mail.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, and that frees up the line again, 1-866-687-7223. Listeners, I put the URL for his book and how to order it in both the email newsletter, if you saved it, as well as the website newsletter, which will disappear today after the show, but the URL will also be in the archives So you have a couple of, you have actually four questions that are here waiting for you. I'm going to give you the one that is going to challenge you first, because the others are not challenging. This is from, I can't believe the phone is ringing again. Boy, it's interesting because some guests drive the phone off the wall, and other guests, the calls never, ever show up during an entire two-hour program. Okay, so this is from Fred in Brentwood. I take issue with your recent statement about RADS. You're taking 20 REMS, I mean, as an implied threshold is potentially misleading. Whether there is or is not a threshold below which no effects take place is unknown and controversial. One can argue that examination of blood cell morphology is incomplete and excessively crude. I'm a scientist with an advanced degree in nuclear medicine. So, Dave, what do you say?
Okay. To the gentleman, he is somewhat right and somewhat wrong. The evidence since Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and every radiation incident and all nuclear power operations form the UN basis for the numbers I have stated, as in 25 REM and other values of radiation. He is correct only in that there is an unknown potential increase of what is estimated between 1 to 1.2% in the rate of cancer in somebody who would be acutely dosed below the 25 REM value. The federal limit is 5 REM for radiation workers. Now, astronauts are in a slightly different category because of the environment they work in, and Department of Energy, NRC, and NASA have their own measuring plans and agreements with that. However, what we're really talking about when it comes to radiation dose is 1 or 2 or 3% per thousand change. We are not saying every single person who flies to Mars is going to die from cancer. That is not the case. We are talking of a background radiation dose change per hour of someone unexposed at 7 millirem. That's 0.007 rem per hour. And what we're trying to get them down is basically a tenth of that. But yes, there is a slight risk.
Okay.
However, if you're overweight, you smoke, you drink, you are at a higher health risk than from the radiation. So, yes, you can sit there and say, oh my God, radiation is bad. Or you can say radiation can be managed, and I prefer to say radiation can be managed. I've seen it done successfully.
Terry in Corpus Christi says, how many round trips to Mars could you make before having to recharge the nuclear reactor?
Very good question. The reactor, as it's currently designed, has the ability to run for a total of 4 hours. Now, the reason for that is you want to load your reactor with that amount of fuel so it can go critical. Then you have to load another amount of fuel to make up for poisons like xenon, krypton, and krypton's not that bad. Xenon's really bad. Xenon and iodine loved neutrons, and neutrons is what makes power. So if you have an atom that's a fusion product, xenon-135, for instance, it's going to try and shut you down. And we in the nuclear power industry call that a xenon-precluded startup, meaning you have so much xenon filled up in your core, you can pull the control rods all the way out, and you ain't starting up. Unless you take the plant cold and by cold, that adds more positive reactivity because you're making the core more dense, more moderation. So, that being said, you have to worry about with your fuel loading and has to be designed in. But right now, the current design is for 4 hours, and we're only running it for 20 minutes. So you could effectively do 3 flights.
Okay. You have a caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
All right. First, I want to comment on the on one of the person that sent the email. Anytime somebody kick up a fuss about anything, it generates controversy. Controversy is an external thing that involves, it can involve as little as one person complaining about something. So when someone says it's controversial, you just let it go out, go in one ear and out the other, because usually, most of the time, they're showboating. They're making a big show and a spectacle.
What are you talking about specifically?
The guy that called saying, oh, there's controversy in saying that the limit is 20 rems.
Okay, let me say something, because, you know, this has taken me right into the Kool-Aid crap that I really hate. So here's the deal, guys. The people who plan these missions know what the hell they're doing, and they are making policy. And I seriously doubt that any of us on the space show right now are going to make the policy. So you can go out there and say whatever you want, Tim, and believe whatever you want, and Dave can do that, and I can do that, and you can write books galore. But unless you guys are going to build your own mission and fund it and have nothing to do with a government program or anybody working for NASA or JPL or any of the huge, big nuclear centers like Brookhaven that do this stuff, you're going to come up against what you're calling and you're attacking, Tim. So here's the deal. Somehow, and this is what's going on all over the damn country, not just in space.
He was attacking him.
Wait a minute. He's not attacking him. He's challenging his facts and his information. That is not an attack. If you can't have a debate, wait a minute. Tim, stop it. It's my show. Okay? I've got the microphone right now. I'll give you the microphone to talk. But we got to do one at a time or we get no place in a discussion. But this is what goes on all over the country on every damn topic whatsoever. People put their ideas out there and damn it, they can be challenged. There isn't any making Dave wrong, making Fred wrong, or anything like that. Nobody is accusing or attacking anybody. If you can't debate the facts and challenge facts, and challenge theories, and challenge assertions, you get nowhere. You're going to see that tomorrow with the likely announcement that this budget super committee can't come to any kind of settlement, and they're then going to go change the law so that the automatic sequestering cuts don't come into play. Nobody can communicate with anybody. Okay, so one of the rules of the space show is we don't do that. Okay, this is a forum for debate and discussion. If there are people out there that have actual solid knowledge like Fred and they want to challenge Dave on his facts, so be it. He's not making Dave wrong. He's not calling Dave any names. And Dave should be able to defend and put his ideas out there in the light of day to stand up or not stand up. And he has done that with his book. Okay, so you can't call in here and get away with it on my show saying, you know, he's going to be negative, he's going to do this, he's going to do that. Uh-uh. Fair debate on ideas are the way the space show works, and I wish the way we had debate in this country. But we don't, unfortunately. So, look, nobody's making anybody wrong. Nobody's calling anybody a name. But damn it, ideas stand up to the light of day or they don't. But what I'm saying is the people who will likely take us to Mars are not the people that I can get to talk about this on the space show for whatever reason or another. It's really hard to get them. But you're going to deal with people who have the knowledge and the facts and who work in aerospace and Brookhaven and NASA and JPL. And more than likely than not, they're going to be constrained by the kind of data that our friend Fred emailed in to us. And so we're not the policymakers here. So unless there is a way to bridge these gaps, and for you, Dave, to say, no, no, pay attention to my analysis, your analysis isn't going to take us to Mars. Now, Tim, I'll give you back the microphone. But please don't call in and say this one's negative because he's challenging this or that. We don't do that on this show. We have fair debate. Ideas hold up or sink under the light of day. And we have lots of really, really wise, intelligent, experienced listeners in all disciplines that know these subjects. And Dave can put his ideas out there. He did that. He's not making the guy Fred wrong either.
No, you didn't understand. Oh, gosh. Look, why did he use a loaded word like controversial? That's to invoke an emotional response.
Because it's controversial in the industry. What are you talking about? I don't know. This is ridiculous.
Dave explained it all. I mean, he pretty much said.
Okay, so you got a different view from someone who is within the industry, who knows the facts and the situation. And so you're saying, I want to accept what Dave said. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. You can accept 100% for what Dave says. I have no problem with that. I'm not invested in what you accept or not. But controversial is not a loaded word. We use that in science and in history and in discussions all the time. Controversy is what brings new development and new things where people sit around and work out their controversies, at least in an ideal world, not in a conflicted world like we're living in now.
It's not used to get people to work things out. It's used to tear down someone else's idea. I'm sorry, but that is how it's
okay, so that's your perspective. That is not the perspective.
I see it all the time.
Well, fine. You see it all the time. I feel sorry for your world then. That is not how it's used in my world. It's not how it's used in academia that I know of.
Let's avoid politics then.
And I don't know if Dave has an opinion on it, but okay, so you believe that controversy is an emotionally charged word. I don't know what to say. I'm not in.
It's over you.
Dave, you want to go? You take it, Dave. I've ranted enough here.
That's fine. The point that I made in chapter 6 on radiation control in the book is to try and look at what did we see for radiation exposures for on orbit, like Skylab, for missions going to the moon, some background information. From what we've done in orbit, and then what people have done, because it's somewhat nebulous until curiosity flies, what interplanetary dose levels are at, because that information is really sketchy. It's almost as sketchy as the gravitational effects, you know, is half a G, is three quarter G, where's the cutoff, so to speak. So people will have, you know, a certain degree of concern about getting dose. Now, we have a word in commercial power. It's called a LARA. And LARA means as low as reasonably achievable. And that basically says you don't go out, you plan your work effectively to get the minimum amount of dose. So you think about where you're going, how much dose you're going to receive, where are low dose areas. You take all the tools that you need, you take everything that you need, in fact, and you go out and execute said job. And that's the way maintenance is done. So you never plan to get zapped, but you try to effectively manage the dose in a very planned, structured, controlled, somewhat proceduralized environment. You also have to understand when it comes to shielding that I discuss in Chapter 6 of the book. We talk about what is the dose, what are we seeing in cosmic rays? And what I found unique is that if I was to look and sniff a supernova going off, I'd see hydrogen, helium, carbon, boron, all those elements, and then I would see heavier nuclei. So
So what do we see when we look at cosmic rays? And it's very interesting, and it's also, if you give me 1 second, Glassner's report from 2000, section 20 on cosmic rays. The report is very handy, well written, and it talks about spectrum of cosmic rays. And in the report, he shows at about 200, 250 MeV, which is about double the radiation center line found in commercial nuke power. You find at 250 MeV, you see hydrogen. Right underneath that, you see helium. And you see this kind of standard deviation kind of curve. So you've got some energies below, some energies above. But you at least have a spectrum. Now, 90% of cosmic rays are hydrogen. They're protons. The other the next 9% is alpha particles, or helium nuclei. Take a helium atom, strip the electrons away. What do you have? You got an alpha particle. Alpha particles, they are charged, and they're not good things to breathe, but they can't penetrate your skin. You can stop them with a piece of paper. But at these energies, probably aluminum foil would probably stop them dead cold. The next spectra is the remaining 1% of heavier nuclei. But I've already knocked out 99% by using food, by using my water tanks, and by using shielding to get that 10th thickness around the crew. Now here's, besides the galactic dose, the other problem is our friend, the sun. If you have a solar flare or a corona mass ejection, a CME, you're going to have a bad day. And a bad day looks like 300 REM for 1 to 2 hours. So, to get it below a fatal level, you want to get the crew behind a water tank with shielding. Get it. Try to raise your shielding factor up to 100, so the exposure is cut to 3 REM. Now, it's only going to last an hour or two. Then you can move about the ship. The storm has passed, just like a thunderstorm. But having sensors and knowing the storm is coming is absolutely essential. So monitoring the sun, very, very critical for successful manned Mars missions. And you have to realize the only time you're at extreme risk is transiting to Mars or transiting from Mars back to Earth. So that explains overall the radiation exposure issue for Mars.
Anything else, Tim? Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I'm listening. Give me a second to collect my thoughts.
Sure.
I like what you said, though, about managing radiation risk and actually putting things into perspective. I do like that a lot. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't really look into.
Yeah, and we do it in my industry. It's an essential, we pre-job brief every key step, and radiation control is one of them. And we always think, for instance, if pipe XYZ springs a leak and we're in the room, what are we going to do, how we're going to exit? So we kind of pre-plan for worst case and plan for the best at the same time.
Why is the Navy so much better in their track record than the commercial power industry around the world?
Part of the problem is, it comes down to, is that in the Navy, we have standardized plants, and only the French have standardized plants. If you go in the United States, you have GE, you have Westinghouse, you have Combustion Engineering, you have all these various designs, and no two plants look exactly the same. Drives the NRC absolutely nuts. In my area of engineering, we have a thing called a maintenance rule. And what maintenance rule does is it levelizes everybody. So all one style of plant, you follow these rules, and this is the acceptance for equipment availability and reliability that you have to maintain. And if you don't maintain it, oh, pity for you, because you're going to get extra help.
So the standardization makes a huge difference then.
Yes, it does. That's one thing. Second is the training. The Navy does an exceptional job of academic training and online training. And it isn't just the 1 year spent in a classroom and 6 months at a live reactor. It's also going out to sea. So really, in about 2 years' time, that individual who has been academically educated under a very intense program also has been nurtured, to say a better, lack of a better word, by skilled operators who know exactly how the program works and how the rules and procedures are set and how the plants operate. This builds in a procedural compliance mindset of always having a questioning attitude, always making sure you do the right thing. And if you see anything out of the ordinary, you stop, you think, and you question before you act. And this is one of the reasons that roughly, I'd say, 25-30% of the commercial nuclear power industry personnel are ex-Navy, because we've already been trained, so to speak. We just grow the size of the power plants a factor of 100.
Okay. Tim, is that it?
No, I got another question.
Hurry up. We're about to end the show.
Okay. What do you think would be the chances of getting a space nuclear power program started if we had
a government that was interested in doing such a project?
Wait, whoa. Is that your question, Tim?
My question is, what do you think would be the what would you think would be the chances if we were to, let's say, have a new administration for 2012 and they want to start something different in the space program?
You could probably do it from the initiation, from the funding aspect. You could do it in as little, I would say, 5 to 6 years minimum time. You want to basically pull in Westinghouse, General Atomics, Aerojet, the folks who were all working out in the Nevada desert, who have all the prior programmatic information, you know, that's collecting dust in their drawers, so to speak, sitting them down, and you're going to laugh when I say this. You also want Coors Beer Company, because they handle the best porcelain in the world. and some of the processing you need is porcelain. So you may want to call Coors and have a few cold ones with them. And you basically want to have a set of collective meetings, corporate to corporate wise with government to basically say, this is the program, this is what we want to build. And that's kind of the flavor of what I put in Chapter 5, in Chapter 4 to a lesser degree, but in Chapter 5 very strongly, I said, if I'm going to run in a nuclear thermal engine direction and I want to optimize my engine for a Mars mission and maximize my delta V and my payload margin, throw it up on the wall, let's see what we got. And what shook out was the pebble bed. The only people who've ever done pebble bed in the United States was Fort St. Brain in Colorado. She was pebble bed. She was a commercial nuclear plant, 45 to 50% thermal efficiency, and used superheated steam. Exit temperature of the reactor was around 2,000 degrees, and it was cooled by helium gas circulating around. Helium gas would boil water, and cold gas would be fed back to the core. So we have experience with pebble bed fuel. We're just putting it in a different container and in a different coolant, but it's not beyond our technical reach. So once you can make fuel granules or pellets, you sinter them down into a moderator, you pour them in, and you sinter it all together, and now you have a fuel element. And since it's never operated, you can handle it with your own bare hands. No radiation risk. Now, when you put them all together and you put that reflector around it and it goes critical the first time because of those fission fragments you're making, now it becomes radioactive. Now you got to respect it. But I would say 5 to 6 years to get at least one, if not two, prototype cores going. And once you get one up to 75,000 pounds of thrust and 2,000 megawatts at 3,100 degrees Kelvin, you're at the sweet spot. You're ready to go fly.
Okay. I'm going to get you off the phone, Kim, and take other callers before we go out. And I've got a couple of emails for you. But if you still want to get in under the line, listeners, you need to call 1-866-687-7223. So you do have a couple of emails here that I've been sitting on.
Sure.
Kelly says, how long would a chemical versus nuclear mission flight be? You've probably already answered that, so you can do that quickly. Can you compare risk of a longer versus a shorter flight? I'm going to add a note to Kelly. What is the difference between nuclear thermal and nuclear electric? I'm going to add that to Kelly.
Sure.
Okay, so there's three things for a short answer because I've still got more questions coming in.
Okay. Nuclear electric is you run a turbine with your nuclear plant makes heat, drives a turbine, makes electricity, and electricity ionizes a gas, and you ionize your gas, and it's an ion engine with a nuclear power plant driving it, essentially.
Okay.
Kind of the idea of Vasmir. The problem with Vasmir was because, as we discussed back in the spring, is the radiator size because he needs 600 megawatts of power, roughly, and 300 of that is going to be waste heat. And I can't build a radiator that big because it's nearly 5,700 by 5,700 feet. So, unfortunately, Vasmir, for a manned mission, unmanned, Vasmir has great, great potential.
Okay, so, nuclear electric.
Nuclear thermal.
Okay.
It acts like a heat exchanger. All it does is heats that gas like we do in a combustion chamber and a chemical rocket engine. it heats that gas, but it heats it up more efficiently than a chemical engine by about a factor of two in terms of specific impulse.
Okay.
So you get reduced trip times by nuclear.
Okay, and Kelly says, so compare a chemical versus nuclear mission flight.
Okay. I can get to Mars in probably 5 months with a nuclear thermal engine and a chemical engine, it's over 9 months. So my radiation dose is basically cut by a factor of four. Now, the numbers I've seen chemical around 60 and nuclear down around 45. And all of that difference, that 15 rem difference is due to the change in trip time because it's time, distance, and shielding.
Okay, and he wanted to know, okay, you did shorter and longer flights. Okay, so you did that. And then Kelly has another one for you. It's a comment. For your information, 2,000 milliwatts is the power of a commercial power plant, yet the big small size monsters would fit in a shower stall. I'm not sure I follow what he's saying, but probably do.
What we're envisioning in the Nerva pebble bed design is something a little bit bigger than your garbage can, glowing white hot, and producing 2,000 megawatts of heat. So I'm taking the power of, I would say, one Nimitz-class carrier per engine, and I'm effectively sticking it in a volume 52 inches high and 48 inches in diameter. And I'm using that to directly heat hydrogen and expand it through a convergent-divergent nozzle.
Okay.
And why do that? Because the traditional Nerva design had an impulse of 825, but with the pebble bed, you get an impulse, a specific impulse of 1,000.
And a typical chemical rocket engine, tell the listener what that is.
453. The space shuttle main engine was 453 on a good day when it was running right.
And
people go there.
The Delta 4 Heavy that you were talking about earlier in the show, what is that?
It's about 442. So if I dump a pound of fuel in, I get 442 pounds of thrust out.
Okay. So we're on a two-hour mark. So what do you want us to know about your book in succinct form before we shut the show down? Because I know you've only gotten through about half the chapters.
What the book really takes is a snapshot today of the future of that we can achieve of exploration of manned spaceflight, looking forward into the future that's achievable based on technology that we can achieve today. Key areas that still need really strong investigation is the use of tethers beyond the small experiments that we did, as I mentioned in the book, in Gemini 11 and Gemini 12, where they got a couple of milliges and proved that the concept worked. And surprisingly, the original idea came from a Bell Labs engineer. What we're saying is tether technology, aero braking, are absolutely strongly need to be researched. We need to have some hard data for both. There is very, very little data right now. If I put a human being on Mars for, say, 2 years, what's the health effect being in that reduced gravity? And I don't think anybody at NASA right now can give me an answer on that one. And those are things we have to investigate. Something we should be doing on the station, in fact. Further, what the book looks at, we talk about the radiation control, we talk about reactor theory, and what we're trying to do is if I have a student who walks in and reads the book, he's going to be able to pick up with a high school level or college freshman, sophomore, junior level, be able to pick this book up and go through all the material, understand it, and apply it, and see why it's laid out the way it is and what the detail is. Now, almost any other textbook going, telling you how to get to Mars, doesn't offer any software, doesn't offer any simulation modeling. This book does. And we have 51 resources. When you buy the CDs, you're not just buying my 700-page book or my 694-page book. There's also, when you go to the resource section, every chapter that I've outlined that we've discussed has background resource material for reading in nuclear theory, in radiation control, in human factors. All of that information is provided to you. And at the same time, you're getting a flight simulation software package so you can fly the mission yourself and use the navigation tools that are built into orbiter. And all the documentation to fly that mission are in the reference library that comes with the book. So in essence, you're getting kind of an encyclopedia of going to Mars. We include also the Mars reference mission reports, the surface operation reports, and we're giving you as in-depth detail that you would have to spend months of your own personal time trying to research, all in one resource.
Now,
I truly believe this book is one of the most in-depth that I've ever created and certainly will stand the test of time.
Okay, and you might tell the listeners that it is available to be read in a e-book reader like the Kindle or Nook, right?
Yes. In fact, I have mine in my Nook. My wife got me a Nook last Christmas, and I have all my books in my Nook for handy reference. And for the Nook, you buy my CD, you put it into your computer, you transfer it with a USB cable to your Nook, and you can read any of the documentations. They're all in PDF format. A few of them are in Word, and the Nook, I know, can read Word documents, can read Excel documents, and can read PDF format.
And the same for the Kindle, or you're not quite as sure?
The Kindle, I think, needs some software, turns them into an MOB format.
M-O-B?
M-O-B. It's a specific Kindle format that converts the PDF files.
Okay. Are you planning another book?
Oh, good question. Not at this time.
This is it.
This may be it. This may be it. If somebody walks up to me and says, you know, Dave, we'd like you to, you know, do some work for us, then do some writing, I'm always open to that idea.
Okay,
these projects take a extensive amount of time and effort, and I certainly miss spending some time in my hobby shop.
Okay, so I have one final question for you, and you're allotted 5 minutes, and I'm gonna gong you if you go over 5 minutes. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
We have a new. Hypothetically, we have a new administration, and they decide to reach out to the space cadet and space advocate community to come to Congress and give testimony as to what our space policy should be, what we should do. Should we be going to point A and B? Should we be doing R&D only? Should we only do commercial? Well, you know, whatever it is. And they want to hear from a variety of space cadets and space advocates and space enthusiasts on this. You have been given an invitation to come and testify. You're allowed 5 minutes to make your statement on what you think our space policy should be for this hypothetical new administration. Go.
I would say good afternoon, gentlemen, in the Senate and in the Congress. My perspective is based on over 41 years in the rocketry community, 31 years in nuclear power, 12 years of submarining, and is flavored with an extensive background of my writing, which I would gladly share with you. The country needs to take a better direction. And if we are to explore, and if we are to motivate the next generation, we have to set goals, and we have to meet goals, and we have to be brave enough and have courage to take risk again and explore. We had in the late 1950s and early 1960s programs like that. They were at Edwards Air Force Base. They were called X-15. It was in the Mercury program, the Gemini program, and Apollo. And yes, we took losses, but we certainly achieved our objectives. I suggest you bring in Homer Hickam. I suggest you bring in Mr. Armstrong and a few other distinguished individuals who absolutely understand the critical nature NASA and the space program play in our collective future. We can be successful. We can lead, or we can fall by the wayside. And nations like Portugal and the New World, they fell behind the wayside and never recovered. Don't let America fall by the wayside. We are the leaders of aerospace. We need to maintain that. And the best way to conceive that is taking men to Mars. With that being said, we need heavy lift. We need the space launch system. And we need nuclear thermal engines. And we need to discover new technologies such as aerobraking, tethering, and other small, lower-cost areas for significant research and development in a short period of time done at the station. We can achieve all these goals, everything that I've outlined in my documentation. Everything's achievable. Everything can be done in a decade, in a short order, maybe a little longer. It's up to you to show leadership, to see that these programs get financed with achievable goals and they meet the mark, and that the NASA management follow the program and embrace it. And at the same time, the country needs to be educated. We have remissed in educating them about nuclear power, about technology, about space, and it is time to make them not afraid, not ignorant, and show them a real future, a potential future that we collectively have. That will bring about a change in attitude to this nation that we have not seen since the 1960s in the Apollo program. We need it. I highly support it. I believe you should as well. Thank you for my comments.
My God, you came in about 30 seconds under 5 minutes. Listeners, just so you'll know, that was not prepared by Dave. I did not let him know I was going to do that. Correct, Dave? This was all off the top of your head, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so don't anyone think we staged this, because
I don't stage it.
No, I only decided to do it as we were ending the show. I thought you handled it really well. Unfortunately, Congress won't listen to you, but that's another story.
That's okay.
In another show down the road. If people want to get a hold of you, how do they do so, or do you want me to filter for you?
People can type my last name, Kepledge, and just Google me, and you'll run into my website. Bottom left side, there's send email. Send me a note. Anybody can write me a note anytime, and I'm always honored to reply. And yes, I do provide information if anyone's doing some neat projects. I'm helping a group out in Kansas right now. They're flying a Titan II ICBM with a Dinosaur X-20 Boeing one-man shuttle on top of it, 1/13th scale, and they're using some drawings and some aerodynamics found in my first book, and really fun project to help them. They sent me pictures of the Titan II with the bird on top, and I just was floored. It was a beautiful piece of work. So we have a lot of fun helping other people out there, and all they have to do, people from the National Association of Rocketry or from Tripoli Rocketry Association, of course, they can reach me anytime via the association or via my website, and I do respond to questions.
Okay, listen, thank you. I hope you do really well with your book, and a great Thanksgiving and holidays to you, and I'm sure we'll be talking on the air down the road again, so I look forward to it.
Thank you, David. I had a wonderful time this afternoon.
Okay, and listeners, thank you all for participating. Back again tomorrow, Tuesday, and then we do have a show Friday morning. You'll see it all in the newsletter. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everybody, and talk to you tomorrow. Goodbye from the Space Show.